Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Alice and I picked strawberries for dinner at Chez Panisse that night. And we each got on, it was a little plane from San Diego to Oakland, and we each got on carrying a flat of strawberries. And the aroma rose up and spiraled through the plane. And one by one, every single person on that plane came over and begged for strawberries.
That's so cool.
You know, and they just said, I forgot what strawberries smell like.
This week, our guest is the woman who I call the first rock star food writer, Ruth Reichel. Ruth's first venture into food writing was a cookbook titled, A Feast, Jerry. I actually have a copy. You gave me a copy of that book. She then co-owned the Berkeley Restaurant Cooperative Swallow from 1974 to 1977 before starting her restaurant critic career at California and New West magazines, respectively. Her first star turn was at the LA Times from 1984 to 1993, where she was the restaurant critic and the food editor. Her name became synonymous with restaurant criticism during her six-year tenure at the New York Times. From there, she became the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine for 10 years before its untimely demise in 2009. Ruth is the author of 7 books, including 4 memoirs, a novel, 2 cookbooks, and most recently, My Kitchen Year, which detailed the year she spent recovering from Gourmet's shockingly sudden demise by what else? Retreating to the kitchen. She's also got serious TV chops. She co-produced and hosted Diary of a Foodie on PBS. She co-hosted and executive produced Adventures with Ruth. Also on PBS, she was a judge on Top Chef Masters. And just for good measure, she's won 6 James Beard Awards. Welcome to Special Sauce, Ruth Reichel. First of all, I have to give you a heartfelt thanks for calling me the missionary of delicious in the New York Times.
Well, that was so much fun doing that piece with you.
Even my wife said, wow, she really captured you.
Well, I mean, really, that was kind of like my dream of what you get to do. I mean, I called you up when I was first at the Times and said, you know, take me on a tour of New York. And we went in and out of all these places in Little Italy, in Brooklyn, and it was kind of a heaven to... And the other thing that happened was, I mean, all these people were in love with you. People were running down the street after
that's
you.
Right. Going, that's right.
Ed, you have to come taste my mozzarella.
That was a great day, and thank you so much for writing that piece. And because the Mystery Delicious moniker has stayed with me all this time. So it's great to see you. We don't see each other enough. You've moved upstate. We used to live around the corner from each other. You've written extensively about life at the Reichel family table. But how would you succinctly describe it?
The real truth is that my mother poisoned people. She didn't mean to, but she absolutely did not understand the concept of spoilage. I mean, she had an iron constitution. She didn't understand that other people didn't. And she also was taste blind. I mean, the opening of Tender at the Bone is this very true story of her waking my father up and making him taste something that he said was the most vile thing he had ever had in his mouth. I mean, my father was, I've never met a person as polite as my father. And if it were at all possible to swallow this, he would have, but he couldn't. And he leans over and spits it into the sink. And my mother looks at him and says, I thought it might be spoiled.
So you literally, she poisoned people.
That's sort of the opening. And then that story builds into the story of my mother inviting people to an engagement party for my brother and putting 26 people in the hospital with food poisoning.
You're not kidding, are you?
I am not kidding. I am absolutely not kidding. I mean, she One of her wonderful tricks was she couldn't resist a bargain. My father liked making steak tartare. She would go to the supermarket, and if there was, you know, hamburger that was a little old that was on special, she would buy it and serve it to people raw.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, there's the classic Jewish thing of you cook things to death. My mother was the opposite. I mean, she would buy, like, you know, 15-pound turkey, put it in the oven for half an hour, and announce that it was cooked. She was bipolar,
yeah.
And it, a lot of it got worked out around food, and so I very quickly learned that the thing to do was push her away from the stove and cook myself.
Your interest in cooking was a matter of survival.
It was absolutely a matter of survival. You know, it was, I mean, the cover of Tender at the Bone is a photograph my father took of me cooking at the age of 7. And you can see that this is not a cute little kid cooking. I am seriously making dinner for us because it was just so much safer. And then it was embarrassing. My mother loved to entertain. And she had actually, I grew up in Greenwich Village, and she had turned our apartment, which was a small, you know, New York City apartment, probably 1,100 square feet that four of us lived in. But she got rid of bedrooms. So we all slept on pull-out sofas so that she could entertain in every room. So she would have these dinner parties where there would be cocktails in the living room and dinner in their bedroom and dessert in my bedroom. And it was really embarrassing when people got sick from her food. So I quickly learned, I mean, I called myself the protector of the guests. And, you know,
awesome.
And when I really liked people, I would try and figure out what kinds of foods they liked. And then when they went to the buffet, I would kind of edge them away from
from the foods from that would really send them to the hospital.
The food that would send them to the hospital, yeah. And, you know, I mean, the day my mother did it, I mean, this party was insane. It was when she was really manic. And, I mean, it was an engagement party for my brother, but she turned it into a fundraiser for UNICEF. And 150 people... she had no facilities to cook for 150 people. And the last bit of that is at the very end, like the next morning, my brother calls and says, you know, 26 of his future in-laws are in the hospital. And my mother said, oh, that's ridiculous. We all ate everything and we're fine.
So when did the pleasure and that you derive from it come in?
I always liked it. I mean, I remember when I was about 8, I sat down and made a list of the things I liked to do. I was trying to think, you know, what am I going to be when I grew up? And the only two things I could think that I really loved to do were read and cook.
And think about that. So when you were 8, it's kind of worked out.
It has worked out, but it never crossed my mind. I mean, you know, I didn't know. I mean, you know, in the 50s, smart people weren't interested in food. I mean, my parents thought
right,
food was ridiculous.
Right, and chefs were really a working class thing to do, and they were never seen, right? They were just cooking.
They were never seen. They weren't famous. They cooked in horrendous conditions. They were uneducated. I mean, it was really blue-collar work.
Right.
And, I mean, my mother was interested in restaurants. I mean, my mother was sort of, she had a crush on Joe Baum and his restaurants in New York. And
Joe Baum was the legendary New York restaurateur who did Forum of the Caesars, the Four Seasons.
Windows
on the World.
La Fonda del Sol.
Right.
The much-lamented Zum Zum.
Right.
He is responsible for many of the terrible innovations, like Hi, My Name Is.
Yes.
Did not happen
right.
before
I'll
Joe
be
Baum.
I'll be your server. Yes, that's
and
true.
And the giant pepper mill.
Right.
Would you like some pepper? I mean,
right.
That's all Joe. I mean, he was
right.
a great showman.
So she liked going out to eat. She almost. Do you think that she knew on some level that it was dangerous and not pleasurable to eat her food?
No, I think she just didn't like to cook.
Got it.
Didn't really care about food, but loved the theater of restaurants and loved the glamour of it. And, I mean, we couldn't afford to go, like, to the Four Seasons. But she read about it, and there was the Picasso hanging there. So when I was about, whenever they opened, we went. I was a little girl, and we went to have cocktails at the Four Seasons, and then we went, you know, I think to Zum Zum for, you know, someplace very cheap for
sausage,
dinner.
Yeah. It's so great that you wrote down the two things that you like were reading and cooking. So when you graduated from high school, you didn't think that food was going to be involved in your work life at all.
Not at all. I mean, it didn't cross my mind.
So you went to the University of Michigan.
I did.
And what did you think you were going to be?
Well, I got an undergraduate degree in sociology because I wanted to, I mean, this is now the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to do good in the world. And then I spent one summer working in the South Bronx as a social worker and quickly learned
how hard that is.
I did not want to do social work.
Yeah, that's like I was a Vista worker in Newark.
Those problems were so intractable.
Yes.
That I had these clients I loved and I couldn't do anything
for
them. Yeah,
I was the same way.
And then I watched a man bleed to death waiting to be seen in
emergency room
in
an hospital.
Emergency room in the South Bronx. And it was just, you know what, I think I'll kill myself if I do this work.
Yeah.
So I switched to history of art and I got a master's in history of art, which I loved studying. And I thought I would be an academic, that I would go to work in a museum or, you know, teach art history.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to New York and I got—
You were living in Connecticut?
Where no, were we were living in Ann Arbor.
Oh, Ann Arbor, that's
and
right.
So I got married right out of
that's
graduate
right, I
school.
Forgot. Yes.
And we moved to the Lower East Side. It was a wonderful time in New York. I mean, Patti Smith's Just Kids, that was the New York we lived in. I mean, mm-hmm. It was like, we lived on Rivington Street right off the Bowery.
The ungentrified, truly artistic Lower East Side.
Right. And you could live there for almost nothing. I mean, we had friends who— this is such a wonderful story. I mean, we had a friend, an artist who lived way down, way east on Rivington Street in a building that was completely abandoned. And he lived on the third floor. And we would go to dinners there and he would sort of put, you know, candles all the way up, up to his place, which was the only inhabited place.
Right.
But the ground floor was buttons up to, like, my waist.
It was like a button factory.
It had been a dress factory, and moths had eaten all the dresses.
So all that was left was the buttons. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So you moved to New York with your husband at the time, but again, still no intersection with the food world.
Well, yes. I mean, what happened was I thought I would go to the Museum of Modern Art and they would say, yes, you know, we're looking for a new curator.
Right.
And, you know, I couldn't find a job that I liked. And, you know, there we are in that neighborhood in those days, the old Jews were still there with, you know, these wonderful gefilte fish shops
and the pickle shops.
And the pickle shops and Gertl's Bakery and Little Italy was still really Little Italy.
Right.
And, you know, you'd go to the Pioneer Market and if you stood long enough in front of a can of tomatoes, some old lady in black would come up and say, what are you going to do with those tomatoes?
Right.
You know, and so I started collecting restaurants and I'd go down to Chinatown and ask the people in the shops there, you know, how do you use these mushrooms? I mean, I was so unhappy in the jobs that I got. Temp jobs, and then I worked for my father for a while. And so I just, on weekends, I just sort of haunted the Lower East Side shopping. And I, you know, made friends with the DiPaolos, and then I would cook, and all our friends would come from Ann Arbor, and, you know, people would drive from the West Coast, and there were always a bunch of people crashing on our floor. I mean, we had this giant loft. And I made these huge dinners three nights a week, four nights a week, because it was fun.
Entirely self-taught.
Entirely, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, people gave me recipes and nobody cooked. So you didn't have to be a great cook because nobody cooked.
Right.
you know?
Sure.
And I was cooking for kids, and they thought anything I made was great.
It was awesome, yes.
And then one day, my husband and I were living with a friend who's a performance artist. We shared the loft with her. And one day she just looked at me and said, why don't you write a cookbook?
And that's how was born?
That's how was born, yeah. And we got, you know, it's a real hippie cookbook. I mean, we got all our friends came and camped out and did the art for the book. And
yes, it has hippie artwork, and the title is a hippie title.
Right, right. But they paid me enough. They paid me a $10,000 advance, which was a fortune to me.
Sure.
Which meant I didn't have to work. I could just write the book and cook for a year. And
yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, it was another time. I mean, today, if you went to a publisher and said, you know, I have this idea for a cookbook, they'd say, you know, can you cook? Where'd you learn to cook?
Right.
Who's testing your recipes?
And what platforms do you have?
Yes. But, you know, in 1971, when I went, I mean, my father was in publishing, so I knew a lot of publishing people. So when I asked, you know, an editor I liked, if I want to write a cookbook, what should I do? And she said, well, you know, you should write a sample chapter and an outline and then show it to me and I'll tell you who to take it to. And so I did this, you know, all our artist friends did art for this sample.
Right.
And I took it to Pace and she called me a week later and said, we'll publish it.
That's great.
You know, but that, I mean, it couldn't
happen
today.
No. That's definitely of its time. And then you made your way out to...
Then my husband was he does site work. He's a sculptor. And he really, being in New York was really hard on him. And, you know, we were working so hard just to be able to afford the rent on the loft.
To not make ends meet.
Yes, exactly. And we went out to this glassblowing workshop one summer where he was helping people build their structures and I was helping people cook. It's now a very famous glassblowing workshop, but in the first couple of years, it was very loose.
Right.
It's just north of Seattle. And on our way down from Pilchuck, we stopped in Berkeley, and it was like, why don't we move to Berkeley?
Right. We'll figure out what we'll do.
Yeah. So we went home. We put everything we owned and our cat in our van and drove out to Berkeley with no idea of what we were going to do.
And that begot The Swallow.
Yeah, The Swallow was a collective.
Of course. It was Berkeley in the 60s.
Yes.
It's a collective. That's redundant.
Exactly. It already existed. I mean, to join The Swallow, you had to work for free for a month. And that was your investment in it. And then they voted on you. And if they voted you in, that had been your investment. If they didn't, you got paid for the 40 hours you had worked. So I had friends who were in the collective, and I almost didn't get voted in. But
you squeaked by.
I squeaked by. And then, you know, again, I mean, it's Berkeley. In the early 70s, Alice had just started Chez Panisse. The people who put up the money for our collective owned the Cheese Board Collective and were connected. I mean, we were all
right.
Connected to each other.
Yeah, you were in this. You were right in the white hot center of what was going on in food, not just in the Bay Area, but what turned out to be going on in the whole country.
But it was really, I mean, what happened in Berkeley was really political. You know, I mean, it really was, I mean, the war ended and we all felt like we ended this war. What do we do now? And food seemed like the, I mean, we were all very aware of the beginnings of agribusiness and the vertical integration of all those big food companies. And Frankie LePay had just written Diet for a Small Planet. And, you know, it was this eye-opening idea of, oh, we're taking 20 pounds of usable protein and feeding it to cattle to get 1 pound of meat out of it. Isn't this insane? And we all became vegetarian. And then we all started dumpster diving because it was a political act. I mean, it seemed like all this food is going to waste. This is wrong. And so food just seemed like an obvious political movement. It never intended to become what Alice now calls the delicious revolution. But what happens is when you're spending that much time thinking about food, you start becoming more and more sophisticated about food. You become a good cook.
And you want it to be good.
And you want it to be good.
And whereas as a political movement, being good was beside the point.
Exactly.
That's funny. So the swallow, and again, you were still self-taught. You were just sort of absorbing, I guess, lessons from people around you, from books, from everyone and anyone, right?
Yeah, and we were all, I mean, the people at the Swallow, I mean, Sherry Verbilla was, I met her at the Swallow.
She's now the restaurant critic at the LA Times and been your friend for a long time.
Yeah, and she lived in our commune in Berkeley. You know, I mean, she and her boyfriend broke up and she said, can I come stay with you for a few days? And 8 years later, she was still there. And she's the most wonderful cook. I mean, she's just a natural cook. But we were a group of people who were, like, overeducated and weird because we all loved food. And, you know, I mean, I remember when Paula Wolfert's The Good Food of Morocco came out, we were all making our own warka.
Right. Yeah. You were, like, you were into it way before. I mean, the food culture has become something so huge and all-encompassing. In a way, it was not. It's become so mainstream.
Right.
And it was not mainstream.
It was so not mainstream. I mean, the moment for me when I really thought, oh, this really has a possibility of turning into something bigger. I mean, I think it's so hard for people who live in today's food world to know what that food world was like, where you couldn't get a good vegetable. I mean, there were no farmers markets. And I wanted to do a piece about the Chino Ranch, which was then and probably still is, you know, one of the great farms.
Yes, I've been. It's outside San Diego, and it's a fascinating family. Some of the members were in internment camps in World War II, and they and I think they sold the land, then they bought the land back, and it's this amazing story, and everything they grow is perfect.
It's perfect, and so I really, well, Alice had found them, and she was using produce from there, and I wanted to do an article about them, and I called them, and they said, well, we don't talk to the press. They're very, you know, these people, they're amazing people. Every one of them, there's seven kids.
And they live on the farm.
Well, some of them do, and some are doctors and lawyers. And so I said to Alice, you know, next time you go to Chino Ranch, take me with you. So she did, and we spent 2 days down there. And, you know, Tom Chino, his parents were failing, and he was doing graduate work in, like, microbiology. And and he came home to farm because that's the respectful thing to do for you. I mean, they're a very traditional Japanese family. And I had not seen produce like that in this country ever.
Right. And so that's when it sort of dawned on you, wow, this could become something that's bigger than something that you and your friends.
The moment was right before we left, Alice and I picked strawberries for dinner at Chez Panisse that night. And we each got on, it was a little plane from San Diego to Oakland, and we each got on carrying a flat of strawberries. And the aroma rose up and spiraled through the plane. And one by one, every single person on that plane came over and begged for strawberries.
That's so cool.
You know, and they just said, I forgot what strawberries smell like.
Yeah.
And it's driving me. And I watched Alice giving dessert at Chez Panisse away that night. Because, of course, this is her great pleasure, right? And I thought, we can grow this food here. I mean, it will change because we can do this and people really want it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how did you switch from cooking to writing about food?
One of my roommate's girlfriends, when New West started, New West was the sister publication of New York Magazine. And when it started, she was doing some writing for them. And she knew I had written this cookbook. she's got wonderful ideas but isn't a real writer, and she asked me if I would help her write her copy, and so I was sort of writing for her. Her editor knew that, but ate dinner at my restaurant every night. And one day he came in and just looked at me and said, you know, you're a much better writer than our restaurant critic, and you know food.
Wow.
Have you ever thought about being a restaurant critic? And, you know, I did not think, oh, a new career.
Right.
I mean, we were dirt poor, right? I mean, I'm working in the restaurant. Doug's doing carpentry. We're both trying to do, you know, he's making art. I'm trying to write. And I just thought, free meals.
Right.
They're going to give me free
meals.
Someone's
going to pay me to eat.
And so I wrote a couple of reviews, and they fired their restaurant critic and gave me the job.
You have a very particular style of restaurant reviewing, and a lot of it involves the way you tell stories. Was it present then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in fact, I wrote what are probably the weirdest restaurant reviews ever written. I mean, the first one I wrote a fairly straightforward one, and I thought, this is kind of boring. I mean, who cares? A little too much of this. And for the second, they asked me to do two trial reviews. And for the second one, I wrote like a film noir script. And it was a restaurant called Robert, a very fancy French restaurant. And I called it Cops and Robert. And it was absolutely a story about a gang that goes to this restaurant. And I gave all the people names. Fingers. I mean, it starts, the names have all been changed to protect the innocent. And it was not like any restaurant review anyone had ever, and I was just entertaining myself.
But that's the way it always goes, right? It turns out that maybe did you feel it that this is really my métier? I mean, I'm sure you are a good cook. I've had your food. But when your writing comes out like that as a manifestation of who you are and what you want to be, doesn't it sort of just inexorably take over your life, your work life?
It does. And that really, writing that, you know, I turned it in. And on the way home, I thought, you idiot. You know, you just blew it. That's not a restaurant review. It's so stupid.
Right. The duck was dry.
Right. And I've done this thing, and I thought all my friends were going to be furious at me because they were so excited about all these free meals that they were going to get. And I really thought I really made it. And in fact, I called the editor and said, I just realized I've given you the wrong piece. Please don't read it. I'm going home. I'll get you the right piece. Just throw that away and I'll be back. And I just thought I would go home and scribble the duck was
right.
Dry. And there was this long silence. And then John said, it's too late. And he is really a little bit of a sadist, and he let me suffer. And then he said, this is fantastic. This is, remember, this is like the 70s. It's new journalism.
Right.
He said, it was a great line. He said, American restaurants are growing and changing, and the writing about them should change too.
Interesting, and that was not the attitude of most food editors at the time.
No, absolutely not. But, you know, New West had two editions. It had a Southern California edition and a Northern California edition. And the Southern California edition was fairly straightforward. The Northern California edition was very zany. We prided ourselves on our kind of craziness.
Right. So then you moved to L.A. And you worked at the L.A. Times. And that also turned out to be a really fortuitous time to be there, because then you had Wolfgang Puck and everything that was going on involving Spago, and which was really in many ways a continuation of what you'd lived through in Berkeley. Right.
Yeah. I mean, actually, before Wolf started Spago, he sent Mark Peel to go work at the cafe at Chez Panisse to learn how to make those pizzas. And so there was a real connection. But L.A. was different. There was so much money there.
Yes.
And
there was an element of glamour.
There was a real element of glamour. It was a time. I mean, you know, Jonathan Waxman said to me once, I can my customers will eat anything. so long as it's not the same thing they ate last night.
Right.
And that at that point, that didn't exist anywhere else.
Right. Interesting. So then you get the New York Times gig, and that's when, again, it just, I mean, there's some luck involved here in that the role that food played in people's lives was becoming so important at the same time that your career was growing. And, you know, it's one thing to do something really well, but if you're doing something really well when the culture is going in the opposite direction, it's not going to have
right.
a positive
no,
outcome.
Absolutely. Now, I was really lucky. I mean, I was like 3 seconds ahead of the zeitgeist and passionate about food at a time when, you know, everybody was, you know, right behind me. And so, I mean, I got to learn on the job,
yeah.
which, you know, nobody could do today.
Yeah.
But
yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I felt that way also about, like, my writing at the Times and then even with Serious Eats. It's like I was just 3 steps ahead of the posse. And you can say, oh, it's genius, that you, but you don't think of it that way. It's just like, you know, you make your own luck. But there is definitely an element of luck involved.
Oh, there's a huge element of luck. I mean, yes, you were prescient with Serious Eats in understanding that this medium was going to be really important in ways that I don't think, you know, I mean, everybody was like a year behind you in that. And you did it in the right way because lots of people then started doing
right.
a version of Serious Eats. But you knew how to do it.
Right. Only and because I've been doing it all of a year, but it, you know.
But your instincts were
yes,
perfect
yeah.
about
oh, well,
what you,
you
should do.
Yeah, yeah.
And you hired the right people. I mean, it's so there is the luck, but there's also, you know, I mean, it's really interesting seeing with journalism now who's surviving and who isn't surviving. And so much of it has to do with how quickly people embrace the future.
Well, this has been awesome. Thank you, Ruth Reichel, for sharing your special sauce with us. We can't wait for the gourmet memoir to come out, My Kitchen Year. And so there are many ways for us all to enjoy the fruits of Ruth's endeavor. So thank you really for being on Special
Sauce. I feel
sauce.
Like I could just talk to you forever. We could just sort of sit in here and, you know, keep going for a few hours.
Yeah, this has been great. It was so good. Well, like we did with Bud, we ended up doing a two-parter. And Danny Meyer, too. Let's just do it. And I will see you shortly. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.